and welcome back to the UK's number one retro gaming podcast show. This is Retro Asylum, episode 320. Coming up, I'll be speaking to Lewis Packwood, who is a freelance video game journalist and author, about his new book, Curious Video Game Machines. But before we speak to Lewis, let's just have a very quick look at some of the latest news. Now, there isn't actually too much going on at the moment. There's a couple of new releases which I want to mention. First one is the Space Invaders Quarter Scale Arcade Machine by Numbskull. That is now available to buy and it looks absolutely superb. I quite like Numbskull's quarter scale stuff anyway, the arcade machines. I've got five of them here, which is Pac-Man, Galaxian, Galaga, Miss Pac-Man and Dig Dug. I never did pick up the Bubble Bobble one. I prefer the more simple games, and I know Bubble Bobble's fairly simple, but it's a two-player machine, and to me, I don't know, I never saw a dedicated Bubble Bobble machine in the arcade, so it wasn't really too nostalgic to me. But this Space Invaders machine looks absolutely superb, and the way the screen looks on it, it looks just like the original. Obviously it's not a CRT, it's quarter scale, there's no way they could put a CRT in it, but it does look very nice. It is quite expensive, retails for about £250 for the standard version. Unfortunately, I don't think I'll be getting one this year. I've not been a good boy. But, you know, if you're on the lookout for a nice Christmas treat, or you want to mention something to your other half to get you, then I don't think you can go too far wrong with that if you can afford it. It does look very, very nice indeed. The other thing that's been released is the Atari 2600 Plus. That goes on sale today. Friday the 18th of November. Sorry, Friday the 17th of November. The 18th is Saturday, and there's something else I'll get onto. But yeah, the Atari 2600 Plus. This is for people who haven't got CRTs. You want to play an Atari console with the old cartridges and controller on your modern TV. We have mentioned it on the show before. I think it's quite a good solution. I have seen that there's a few compatibility problems. I know the biggest game that doesn't work at the moment is Pitfall 2. But the firmware on this console can be updated, so hopefully the new incarnation of Atari pull their finger out and get it working with more games. So again, another Christmas gift. You know, Christmas is just round the corner really, so it retails, I think it's £100 here in the UK via Amazon. So, yeah, that looks quite nice. It's 20% smaller than the original console, but the logo lights up, which makes up for it. It does look very, very smart indeed. Now, the last bit of news I'm going to mention is that it's the Crash Live event this weekend on Saturday the 18th. That's why I was getting my dates all muddled up. And unfortunately, I won't be there. I would have liked to have gone, because the Spectrum Next team, so I'm told, will have a one-level demo of Target Renegade for the Spectrum Next. Now, as regular listeners will know, I really like the Spectrum Next, but we don't really mention it too often on the show anymore, and that's because there hasn't been really any massive releases for it. But with the new Kickstarter 2 version coming soon, there's a new batch of games coming out for it. Way of the Exploding Fist and Head Over Heels. But Target Renegade for the Next is the one that I'm looking forward to the most. I'm a massive fan of the game, so much so that I worked on a PC remake a good number of years ago, and I coloured in Dawn Drake's original graphics, put a load more colour in there, you know, all backgrounds, added a bit more detail. Anyway, those graphics sat on a hard drive for years because the PC remake never really got finished. And when I heard that the Spectrum Next team were going to tackle Target Renegade, I sent them all my work with a load of notes for, number of animations and timings and stuff, so they could try and get the game as close to the original as possible. And a little birdie tells me they've done that. This demo is going to be available for people at the Crash Live event. I'm gutted that I won't be there to play it. So if you are there and you can get some footage and play the game and let me know what you think of it, it would be, I'd appreciate it, and hopefully you enjoy it. I've seen screenshots, it does look very nice, but I've not seen it move. I don't even know if it scrolls or if it's got a flick screen scroll like the original had. So yeah, if you go to the event, hope you have a good time, and enjoy Target Renegade. Anyway, let's speak to Lewis Packwood, the freelance journalist and author, about his book, Curious Video Game Machines. Hello, welcome to the show, Lewis Packwood.
Hello, how are you doing?
I'm good. Now, Lewis, the audience won't know who you are, really. They would have read some of your work, no doubt, probably without realising. So tell me, How did you get into the scene originally when you was a kid, or was you a bit older, or what happened? Yeah. Tell us all about it.
Well, I guess I've been into video games ever since I was about five. I remember my dad had a Sinclair Spectrum that I kind of used to play on quite a bit, Horace Ghost Skin and all that kind of stuff. But it's taken me a long time to kind of get into game writing. I kind of started as a freelance game journalist about 10 years ago, just doing the odd bits here and there. I did stuff for Kotaku UK and Eurogamer, and I've just built it up since then. And now, at first, I was doing it kind of part time, just every now and then in the evenings. Yep. And now I do it full time. So I work for The Guardian, Edge, occasionally do stuff for Rock Paper Shotgun and Why Now Gaming, and I've done bits for PC Gamer, everything. Retro Gamer, yes. I was going to say Retro Gamer. So I do quite a lot of stuff for that. I've done a few pieces for them over the years. I did big thing on the history of games magazines for the 200th issue. And what have I done? I've done things on the history of Balance of Power, history of Commandos, history of the Settlers, Skid Marks. I've done lots, lots and lots over the years.
Yeah. And you're starting off on the Spectrum, so you're good in my book.
I used to remember playing that. My dad had one. I could have sworn he said he bought it for work. I never saw him actually do any work on it.
No one done any work on them, really.
He had one of those little thermal printers. Do you remember those? Little receipt roll things, you know, which the most useless printer that's ever been invented. Literally nothing you can do with them. But they kind of look cool, and they make a cool noise when they're kind of printing
things
out.
Yes, when they print it out, they did sound cool. You're right, yeah. My friend's dad, he used a Spectrum for work, apparently, and he had the same printer. I do remember that noise. We used to print, we'd do loading screens and our own graphics on it and try and print them out.
Yeah, that's right. I think that, I remember printing out the screen from Horace Goes Skiing and just being amazed seeing this little thing appear on this little tiny till roll. But I'm not sure actually what else you could use it for apart from just going, oh, look, I can print out this game screen. But no, I played on my dad's Spectrum, and then I got I think my first proper machine that I owned was a Game Boy. I remember that when it came out, and then got an NES, and then an Amiga 500. I remember that, and then an Amiga 1200, and then a Super NES, and it went on from there. PlayStation,
snowballed.
I've just always loved games. Never stopped playing. Really, I think a lot of people get to that stage. You know, after university or when you're in your 20s. You know, a lot of people, you know, they kind of stop playing, and I never did. I think probably all the people who listen to this podcast probably never stopped playing.
No, that's it. I mean, I think I went for I won't say a break because it wasn't a break. I definitely wasn't playing as much, you know, when I met my wife and what have you, but I soon got back into it fully, like I do now.
That's
where
it.
She's always moaning that I'm down here in the shed playing games and not with her or the kids.
I've got to say as well, what a marvellous looking shed you have. I mean, it's you say it's a shed, really. It's kind of like an arcade palace at the end of your garden.
Look, I'll pan the camera around so you're seeing that end.
Look at that.
I've got a heater there. That's what that big glow is. the shed isn't on fire. Yeah. So it's quite a big shed. Yes. I'm very lucky.
It looks beautiful. Lucky. I wish I had a shed half as nice. I've only got a yard, so I don't really have room for a shed, which is a shame.
Right.
I might have to dig into the ground and have like an underground shed.
Yeah. Well, I'm jealous of people who can have rooms like this in their actual homes, you know, in their houses. Because I have to have the heater on half an hour before I come. I'll stick it on half an hour on before I come down here properly. Because I don't want to blow up my arcade machines and CRTs that I've got.
Oh, God, yeah. Now that's a danger.
Yeah,
no,
you've got to be careful, especially in the winter. Now it's turning cold. I put them on an hour a day, even if I'm not playing them, just to keep the caps nice and warm.
You don't want a frozen Defender machine.
No, exactly. No. That would cost money. Yeah. So, doing this full time, what made you want to write a book? Was it just a dream you've always had?
Oh, well, I'm glad you asked me that, Dean, because it is a dream. I think everyone kind of like feels like, oh yeah, I can write a book one day. But the thing that kicked this thing off was actually an interview I did for Retro Gamer. So I spoke to Chris Crawford a couple of years back. So Chris Crawford used to work for Atari. He did the Atari 2600 conversion of Missile Attack.
Yeah.
And various other games, and then he left and he formed his own company and released Demon Attack. Missile Command was the one he did afterwards. And then he did Balance of Power on the Mac, and that was this Cold War simulator. And later on, he went on to form GDC, the Game Developers Conference.
Yeah.
So, you know, he's kind of a veteran. So I was speaking to him about Balance of Power, and just at the end of the interview, he said, oh, have you seen this? I just wanted to show you some pictures of this. And it was this bizarre machine that he'd cobbled together out of bits of wood and perspex. And he was like, yeah, this is Kim Tanktik's. I made this in like 1977. I was like, what's that? And he kind of told me all about it. And it turned out it's like one of the first ever war games ever made, you know, that he just knocked up together. He bought a Kim 1 kit computer, which was one of the first microcomputers kind of available in the US. You know, it was that and the Altair, I think, was it with the other one. And he bought this kit computer, made it himself, and then kind of like modded it and put in all these extra bits and made some controllers and created this war game called Kim Tanktik's, where you would hang a blanket between the two players. And there was little kind of digital kind of like displays, LCD displays on each these things he called the tiny terminal, which would tell you the position of your tank. And then it came with this hexagon-based grid as well. And you had to sit there and try and – you had about – I think it was five tanks on your team and your opponent had five tanks. And you had to sit there and use this little hex map and try and work out where your opponent was and shoot them just based on the grid coordinates that were kind of given on the screen. So he made this all himself. And no one had ever played it, really. He took it to some kind of like shows in California, like wargaming conventions and things like that. And a few people played it. But, you know, maybe a few hundred people have ever – seen or played in this machine. And I thought, that is fascinating. And then it kind of made me think, what other weird stuff's out there that I've never heard of? You know, this machine that was kind of made before the Atari 2600 came out, you know, this is, no one was doing this kind of real, it was a real time, you know, real time kind of like tank game. It was an amazing like advance, you know, considering at the time most people were playing like Pong and thing really simple and Breakout and stuff like that. And he was kind of making this really sophisticated kind of war game simulator. So that kind of kicked me off. And I thought, well, I want to write about this. But then something so weird and niche, it's difficult to kind of like pitch that to somewhere like, I don't know, Eurogamer and say, oh, I want to write about this. And I thought, well, maybe this is something, because there's been a few of these stories down the years that I've kind of heard and I've been fascinated by. There's this whole kind of substrata of really odd machines that no one really ever talks about and only perhaps dedicated collectors ever know of. So I thought, well, I think this is fascinating. If I find it fascinating, other people
absolutely
are bound to find it fascinating.
I mean, you've sent me a PDF of the book and I'm just looking at this right now, and I've never seen it, and you're right, it is fascinating. And how do you go about making a war game out of calculators? It's, that's yeah. what essentially it is.
I know that. I mean, he did use calculator bits. You know, he ordered all these kind of calculator screens and made these little game controls, these tiny terminals, he called them. And he made them from scratch, you know, with number pads and things. And
I mean, there's one thing programming, but you've got to be a genius, haven't you, to be able to put all this together. That's amazing. I think Chris, that is amazing.
Chris, he's an extraordinary man, Chris Crawford. I think he's one of those people that once he gets an idea in his head, or he doesn't realize he doesn't know about something, he wants to know everything about it. And when he did Balance of Power in the mid-80s, you know, he did this kind of Cold War simulator, which is like nothing had ever been done before. It's this crazy thing where you kind of have, you play as one of the superpowers, Russia or the US, and then the idea is to kind of expand your territory of influence without triggering nuclear war. And as soon as if you trigger nuclear war, then it's game over. But while doing that, he did so much research that he actually wrote an entire book about the Cold War called Balance of Power. And I've got it on my shelf, actually. I don't know. I'll show you up here. Yeah, look, this great big thick thing. He wrote that as a result of kind of making the game, you know. And it's just all about how he sees the game as like an influence, how it ties into real world politics and things like that, and gives some examples of things that happen in the game that happened in the real world. And fascinating. So he's a fascinating dude, and that was really the trigger that kind of said, right, this could be a book. And I did that chapter. I wrote a chapter on Kim Tanktik's, and I kind of used that as a sample chapter, and I thought, right, I'll use this. And I wrote a big long book proposal that was about, you know, 10 pages long or something, and I included this chapter and I said, you know, this is ready to send off. You know, I'd never done this before, so I thought, all right, okay, I'll steel myself and send this off to some publishers, and I'll probably get rejected, but you know, I've done this sample chapter and I've done all this stuff, and I sent it off, and I thought, well, Chris Scullion's done his encyclopedias, his amazing kind of NES encyclopedia and SNES encyclopedia. I'm sure you've seen them. So I thought I'd approach White Owl, his publisher, and sent them off, and they just loved it straight away. And I was like, oh, right, I did that whole book proposal. Maybe I could have just called them up. And was that necessary? I spent a long time writing that book proposal. I was kind of envisaging kind of sending it around publisher after publisher, but no, they were like, oh. I was like, oh, that was easier than I thought it would be. But they were keen to go with it. So I'm glad I got to write it. And there were a few things I've done down the years like that, I thought immediately, right, well, I could include something about that, do a bit more in depth. Back in, I think it was 2013 or 2014, I wrote about the Galaxia for Eurogamer, which was this amazing story about this kind of computer that this guy, Vlado Antonic, who was from Serbia, kind of like came up with. There was this time in Eastern Europe, well, particularly Yugoslavia, was kind of a special case. It wasn't really part of the Iron Curtain. It wasn't behind the Iron Curtain. It was like its own thing. It was neither communist nor kind of capitalist. It was a weird, self-contained kind of state. But it had these laws in place where you weren't allowed to import anything that was worth more than 50 Deutschmarks. I don't know why it was set at that particular level. But it meant that no one could import C64s or Spectrums or computers of any kind, really, because they all kind of fell foul of this limit. So the only way you could ever get hold of one was by, you know, smuggling them, essentially. And so Vlado Antonic kind of had his brainwave when he was on holiday. He was like, right, I'm going to make a computer where all of the individual parts cost less than 50 Deutschmarks. You can source them for all these different places, and then I'm going to make it open source so anyone can make this computer, and I'm going to publish the instructions and then anyone can make one because no one's got computers. And then, you know, and he did it. And he got together with the editor of this kind of science magazine, this science and computing magazine. And they put out a special issue and they published the instructions for how to make a Galaxia. And loads of people did it. Thousands and thousands and thousands of people kind of made these little machines. But the beauty about the Galaxia is that no two look the same. They're all completely unique and individual.
Gotcha,
There was no case. There was no standard case or anything. In fact, the instructions didn't even specify to kind of make a case. So a lot of them were kind of built and just left naked with all their circuits exposed. And then other people kind of came up with their own cases. You know, they made them out of metal or they made them out of wood and all this kind of stuff. So it's kind of a very odd machine. And I recommend kind of hunting for pictures of the Galaxia because you'll see that no two kind of like look the same. And then kind of Antonisci's kind of the legacy of this, you know, it really sparked a generation of people getting into computers. And then I think the year after it came out, it's like 1984 or something like that, they changed the law. So suddenly people could import the C64s and all that kind of stuff. And the Galaxia was kind of rendered a little bit obsolete because it wasn't that powerful. It wasn't very powerful at all. It wasn't as powerful as a Spectrum, for example.
Yeah. I'm wondering, is that the first open source computer, do you think, or projects?
One of them, certainly. And Antonisci's like, he's kind of really committed to open source and he still works now. You can find him on the website Hackaday. He moved to California a few years ago. And he's now kind of a darling of the hacker scene over in California. And the story of the Galaxia, you know, wasn't widely known when I kind of first wrote about it, you know, 10 years ago. And since then, quite a few people have picked up on it. And now he's kind of a bit of a hero kind of to the software hacking scene over there. And he's a wonderful man. And all of the stuff he does is open source. He doesn't believe in kind of like, you know, keeping hold of this technology. He just wants to put these ideas out there and let people kind of tinker with them. So yeah, he's an amazing man. So yeah, there's an interview with him in the book. I spoke to him all about the Galaxia and filled in quite a lot of the details. And it's a really interesting scene. They've actually just republished the original magazine that the instructions were given on, but they didn't have the photos or so they've recreated all of the photos from the original magazine using new kind of like new Galaxias. They've rebuilt the kind of things to show you step by step how to make it. Because it's become quite a cult kind of thing over there. And
Everyone
some of the pictures in
one.
The book. Yeah, that's it.
Wow. That's amazing. Maybe some of our listeners will be able to make their own.
Yeah, well, you can, yeah.
Why not?
Yeah, research.
Yeah. I've never, you know, like I say, a lot of the stuff that's in the book, I've not actually heard of. So this, you know, this for someone like me who thinks they know everything, I'm getting proven wrong here. Yeah? I mean, there's even Atari's Forgotten Consoles, a section in the book where I remember seeing various different Pong machines, but you know, you've got a lot of stuff in here.
There's a really interesting one, the Atari Video Music, where they
kind
of made
it. Yeah, I'm just looking at that, 1977.
It was one of the first ever video synthesizers. So you kind of hooked it up to your hi-fi system and played music through it, and it generated all these shapes on screen in time to the music. And it was a massive flop. Like, you know, the Atari engineers at the time, you know, well, let's say they may have been
influenced
at the time when they came up with this thing. But it's an amazing thing. But it was really expensive. I mean, it was cost the equivalent of something like $1,000, you know, back in 19. And it didn't do very well and it flopped, but it's a remarkable thing. And it had quite a long legacy, really, because it, you know, it ended up, I think there's a video for a Devo song where you can see in the background they're using enough video music to generate the images. And there are all sorts of video synthesizers kind of later on, I know, that have kind of come along, but this was one of the first ones. So yeah, there was all sorts of odd Atari. There was video pinball as well. They made a pinball machine and Atari Stunt Cycle, which is just a pair
of
handlebars.
That looks interesting. Yeah, what's the story with that? I have seen pictures of that before, but I've never really looked into it.
So it's based on an arcade game called Stunt Cycle, and you kind of race down. Imagine like a motorcycle handlebars, and you turn the throttle on one hand, and that's all the controls. That's literally it. You
that
just turn the throttle. But then the idea is to kind of turn the throttle, and you've got this little motorbike that goes across the screen, and it goes across the top of the screen, then the middle of the screen, and then the bottom of the screen.
Yes,
and the idea is
you
have to kind of maintain to go fast enough so that you're able to make the jump at the bottom of the screen, and you have to jump over a certain number of buses, I think it is. But if you go too fast, then he'll wipe out or flip, he'll pull a wheelie and kind of fall back. So you kind of have to gently kind of maintain the right level of throttle. And of course it came out, the arcade game came out at the height of, Evel Knievel fever. I think it was 1974 or 75.
Right.
And, you know, Evel Knievel was huge. But by the time Stunt Cycle came out, the home version of this arcade game, I think Knievel fever somewhat died off.
Died down, yeah.
I think by that point he'd been arrested and was imprisoned. And at the same time, in like 1977, I think was just this ridiculous saturation of Pong consoles and these dedicated kind of consoles.
Yeah.
So, you know, back in the early days, you didn't have interchangeable cartridges.
Different consoles, you're right.
You bought different consoles to get different games. And most of them were Pong or very, very similar to Pong.
I was just looking on the Stunt Cycle. It's got Stunt Cycle, obviously, Drag Race, Motocross, and Enduro. But they're probably just slightly different versions of the same game.
Yeah, how did you guess? Yeah,
basically, with the Pong machines.
Basically, yeah. So I can't remember the difference between all of them, but one of them was like each, you have little ramps you have to hop over all the way. Another one's just how fast can you go from start to finish without kind of wiping out. So yeah, very small variations. But it turned up in some other machines as well, that same game. It wasn't just the Atari one. It did end up kind of going on to... And altogether, I think there's a stat somewhere in the book that there were over 900 Pong consoles or variations on Pong consoles produced around the world, which is phenomenal when you think about it. Like just the sheer number of people putting out these little machines that kind of played Pong or games very similar to
everyone
it.
Everyone jumped on the bandwagon though, didn't they?
Exactly. And then there was this kind of little known about video game crash in 1977 when all of these, you know, things just, people were like, oh, there's too many. The market's completely awash with, oh, there's only so many Pong consoles people want or can buy. And so that was like the first game crash.
Which isn't really spoken about at all.
No, you don't really hear about it.
No. Yeah. I'm just looking at the German console, the Interton, is it?
Oh, yeah. Now, that is a fascinating story. I found out about the Interton. So when for doing this book, like I've kind of reached out to some collectors of consoles and rarities. There's a few of them. And Darren Selfridge in the US, he's been particularly keen. He's got an amazing collection of consoles. And it was him who told me about the Interton. And I'd never heard of it. And he was like, oh yeah, have you heard about this German console that was like a rival to the Atari? And I was like, what? Germany made consoles? And yeah, Interton was actually a hearing aid company,
right.
And they decided to get into video games for some reason. And the first console they made was the Interton 2000, I think it was.
Yeah.
Which was based on the Magnavox Odyssey from 1972. So if you look inside, it's kind of mostly kind of analog circuits, not really based on microchips or anything like that. But it did come with cartridges like the Odyssey did, but it was kind of not quite the same as the Odyssey. I don't know if you know about the Odyssey, where it came with cartridges, but essentially all that did was reorder the wires. You know, if you look inside the cartridge, it just kind of reroutes the wires. So essentially, and all the games are basically on the machine, and you just kind of reroute it to kind of change.
It was a bit like dip switch settings, really, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Something like that, in a way.
That's right. And the original prototype that Ralph Baer made actually had just a switch on the machine to change between the games.
Yeah.
But the 2000 was kind of a bit of a weird hybrid because the cartridges, it worked on a similar principle where, you know, it generated four rectangles of different sizes. But then the cartridges themselves actually had little diodes and extra transistors and things on them that generated more things. So there was one called Super Tennis, I think it was. Or Super Table Tennis, and that had a load of circuits on it for generating a scoreboard, which the console wasn't able to do without those things. So it was an odd thing. So that was their first one. I think that was very early. It was like 1975, I think. So it was one of the earlier kind of Pong machines that was available. But it basically just played Pong and some slight variations. And then they released a couple more. Where they switched to kind of chips, because by that point that you could buy Pong on a chip essentially. But then in 1978 they released the Interton VC 4000, which was an actual console with interchangeable cartridges, and it was a really odd machine. I mean, if you look at it's actually on the cover of the book, so you can see it on there. It's got analog controls for a start,
yeah,
which is kind of quite unusual for the 1970s. And it was powered by, I think it's the Signetics 2652, I think is the name of the chip. It was a chip made by Philips, although it was actually, Signetics was a Californian company and Philips kind of bought them. Philips is based in Europe. And this is a weird little chip. So, you know, the MOS 6502 was the kind of chip of choice for a lot of consoles. You know, the Atari 2600, they used the variation of it, and it kind of turned up in various other things like the C64 and stuff like that. But then There's this Signetics one, which no one's ever heard of, which kind of is like the alternative thing. And it's not quite as powerful as the 6502, but Philips kind of were pushing it, and it ended up being used in the Intercom VC4000. But it also ended up being used in a ton of other consoles that were released around the same time. And I tracked down, there was so many of these different consoles, and people have reported that you could play games made for one on a different machine. I was like, oh,
right,
what's going on
okay,
there?
Yeah.
And I tracked down, one of them was called was by Radofin, this company. So I tracked down the guy who used to run the manufacturing plant in Hong Kong. And I said to him, you know, can you shed a bit of light on this? And you know, the internet and the Signetics thing, you know, what's going on here? It's like, oh, yeah, we made all of those. Yeah, we just made them all. And different companies were putting orders, and we just put a different case.
Right, so it's coming out of the same factory.
It's all coming out of the same factory. And they're just putting different cases on and then shipping them out. And I was like, well, why are all, you know, what about the Interton? He was like, well, we didn't have anything to do with Interton. And I was like, but how come that, like, there's all these games that are on the Interton VC4s, and they're also on these other machines, these 1262 kind of programmable machines. And he was like, yeah, well, Philips just gave them. They just gave us like half a dozen games or whatever, and said you can just use these, whatever. So quite a lot of the games were just provided by Philips or Signetics. We're not quite sure. We think it's Philips, but I think that it feels like there's still lots more to kind of learn about this. I did quite a lot of digging and kind of get that far, but the fascinating thing, I think, with that and with a lot of the machines I've covered in this book is that there's hardly anything's been written about them. Like, no one knows anything about them. And even kind of getting, you know, some little details like that is like a real achievement.
Yeah. I mean, just tracking down that guy is amazing that you've been able to find him.
Yeah, yeah. But there's more I want to do, though. I want to find out more. But I hope this book can be kind of like a starting point for other people and other researchers and other writers. They might kind of have their kind of be intrigued by some of the things in it and maybe go out and do a bit more research and find out a bit more, because I could only get so far. I mean, there's a few people I would have loved to have spoken to for the book, and I just, for whatever reason, wasn't able to find them or they wouldn't respond to messages. So it would be amazing if someone could kind of come along and pick this up and carry on.
I'm just looking through. It's bringing back a lot of memories. The Merlin by Parker Brothers.
Yeah. So
a friend of mine had that in primary school. I do remember.
Yeah,
that.
The Merlin. They were everywhere. They were huge. Absolutely. There's kind of really weird little things that look like a phone. But
yeah,
just very strange little. But I kind of dug into a little bit of that. So the, you know, before there were kind of video games became really popular, it was electronic games, you know, things like Simon and Merlin and all that. And so I did a chapter on the Microvision, the MB Microvision, which is like the grandfather to the Game Boy. You know, 10 years before the Game Boy came out,
yes, this had cartridges, didn't it?
It had cartridges, although there were really weird cartridges,
like overlay sort of thing that slid into the machine, didn't it?
That's right. Well, on the machine, there wasn't really the cartridges were the machine in a way, the actual machine, all it came with was essentially an LCD screen and a little chip to kind of. I can't remember exactly what it did now. It was to do with the screen, and then a little what would you call it, like a pressure pad for the buttons. And then the cartridge, it was actually each individual cartridge came with a microcontroller on it that had that ran everything, really. So there was no kind of like CPU on the actual base unit. Each cartridge is essentially like a little mini console that you plugged onto the front, and all it was using was the screen and the kind of like key overlay. Very odd little thing. It was designed by Jay Miner, who not Jay Miner. What's his name? I've forgotten his name. He went on to design the Vectrex.
Yes, I forgot his name too. I can't think of it.
Is it Jay Smith? I'm gonna have to look at my own book and double check that. I think it was Jay Smith.
I think it's Jay Smith.
He went on to do the Vectrex a couple of years later. But the Microvision, he wanted to do more of the Microvision. And it was MB's idea to make it so massive because it's a huge, chunky, great big thing. I don't know. It's about the size of like a pencil case, or a long pencil case. Do you remember cases? Oh, we could reminisce about those. Yeah. But yeah, it's a big thing. And it was MB who decided to, they wanted to make it massive. And then it was because it was the idea that if the bigger it was, the more expensive it seemed. Which is a strange idea.
Well, it's the American culture, isn't it? I think. They did like to make their products bigger. Just for the sake of it, because they thought it was more quality, I guess. I don't know.
It's that's it.
A bit of a strange way of thinking. Sorry, go on.
I was going to say the Microvision did end up influencing the kind of Gamer Watch and the Game Boy. I know the designer, one of the designers of the Game Boy, I think he's quoted it. Is it Satoru Okada? He was a big fan of the Microvision, and it kind of did influence them later on. And I'm assuming this isn't a coincidence. One of the release games for the Game Boy was Alleyway, which was a version of Breakout, and the packing game for the Microvision was Blockbuster, which was a version of Breakout.
So, I've never had a go at one of those. I must try and find one. I don't know what screen quality's like though, especially, you know, they would have aged. So
the screen is terrible.
Yeah.
It's really bad, but it's interesting that some enthusiasts now have actually kind of got together and made replacement screens because they are very prone to screen rot, these things, and then they do kind of like degrade really badly. They leak incredibly badly, so you can actually buy replacement screens thanks to some intrepid kind of folks who have worked out to make one.
Amazing. So the book is called Curious Video Game Machines, and I'm looking for it, as I say, and I'm just discovering lots of stuff that I didn't know about. It's amazing.
It's remarkable. I mean, there's 18 chapters, and I've kind of covered what I've tried to do is do things in depth. So for each thing, I've kind of tried to give some context, you know, explain what was happening at the time, you know, like for the chapter on the Enterprise 64, kind of this British microcomputer, I've tried to explain, you know, all about the rise in microcomputers and the, you know, what was happening at the time, and give some proper context and try and speak to some people who are involved or collectors who know about these kind of things and give a real deep dive into each one. And so there's 18 chapters, but I mean, there could have been five times as many. You know, even just writing the book, I found dozens more kind of machines that I'd never even heard of and kind of want to write about. And there are some that I wanted to write about, but just didn't have enough information to make it worth it. Like I wanted to write about Russian computers at one point, and it was just so hard to find any kind of information on them. And then kind of there was the invasion of Ukraine, and I was like, okay, we'll put that on the back burner for now. But there was all sorts of stuff, and I'd love to do a sequel and write more about this kind of stuff.
I was going to ask you, actually, do you think you will end up doing a second book?
I really hope so. I'd love to do one because there's so many more things I want to write about and so many more real odd things, and more of some of the more recent ones as well. The publisher has basically said, let's see how this one sells.
Sure.
So this is a call out to everyone. Buy this book and then I can write another one and do some more.
Well, I'm looking through it. I had no idea that Gary Kitchen had made a little handheld game. Wildfire.
Yeah, he did a couple of those, yeah. He did that one, and there was another one. There was a bank heist one, I think. And it was a bit of a baptism of fire because he'd kind of been learning electronic engineering, and then the little kind of firm he worked for said, oh, Parker Brothers, we've signed a contract with Parker Brothers. They want this kind of little pinball game. But the guy who said he was going to program it for us has pulled out, and we've got 6 weeks. Can you do something? So we kind of basically worked through the night for 6 weeks to kind of like come up with this little thing. And that was like his first entry into electronic games. And then he went on to do like Donkey Kong for the, we did a few different versions of Donkey Kong, and then he worked for Activision and all sorts of stuff.
I was going to say, did he do Keystone Capers? One of my games.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. That's right. Yeah.
That's one of my favorite games on the 2600.
Yeah, that one. And then he went on to do, he formed, oh God, what's the name of the publisher? Absolute Entertainment. And they went on to do all sorts of games. They put out, he formed that with David Crane. And they put out A Boy and His Blob and Simpsons, Bart versus the Space Mutants, and loads of other Simpsons games. And so, yeah, they did quite a lot of stuff in the NES years.
Yeah, I think he's actually gone back to doing some Atari 2600 games recently.
He has. Do you know what? Hold on, I'm going to get this one down for you. One sec. He sent me this. This is Circus Convoy, one of the ones he
worked on. Ah, yes, one of his newer games, yeah.
Yeah, that's it. That's quite a fun little thing. Him and David Crane are kind of working on these new games. Yeah. That's quite lovely, really. It's nice that it's kind of come full circle.
Yeah, yeah. I'm just looking through more. Sorry, there's just so much stuff in here. Stuff on the Enterprise, which we know about. You got a little section with Ben Heckerdorn.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, the Enterprise. One of my favourite chapters is on the Halcyon, the RDI Halcyon. So this was a Laserdisc console that kind of just disappeared. And I first found out about it when I was reading Tristan Donovan wrote this amazing book called Replay, The History of Video Games, which is a fantastic book about game history. It's probably the best I've ever read. So I'd highly recommend reading it. But the Halcyon gets a mention of about one line. It's about two sentences. And he just says, oh, when Rick Dyer made this Laserdisc console. And I was like, what? There was a Laserdisc console made by Rick Dyer, the guy who made Dragon's Lair. And so, but that was all I kind of had to go on. So I had to try and find out more. And there's very little information on it. But I was lucky enough, the collector I mentioned earlier, Darren Selfridge, he amazingly has got a Halcyon. Now, bear in mind, we think there are only maybe 6, 7, 8 of them in the world.
Really? Wow.
Yeah,
so if you see one on eBay and it says rare, it might actually be rare for once.
No one's quite sure exactly how many there are, but there's probably no more than a dozen.
How much were they when they come out? Because I thought that, you know, Laserdisc games, they were just in the arcade and that was it. I didn't realise it was a home console.
Well, that's it. I mean, it didn't really officially come out. There's a news report from the time that says that it was in select stores, and this was kind of in late 1984, early 1985, around that time, that it had been sent out to select stores. And there's this footage of like all these boxes of these consoles, you know, in this warehouse. But then the company, RDI, Rick Dyer Industries, went bankrupt just before the console was meant to be officially launched. It was about early 1985. And then all the ones that have turned up that people have found seem to be unfinished. Like they're not quite done. They look like prototypes rather than finished things. Yeah. But it does leave a bit of a mystery open, you know. And certainly if you look at this news footage, there's, you know, boxes and boxes of these things all stacked up in a warehouse, which kind of makes you think, well, either there's loads of them that are out there that no one knows about, they're in some sort of lockup somewhere, or those boxes were empty, or the stock just got destroyed. We just don't know.
Yeah, yeah.
But the weird thing
was, have any games been found for it?
Yes, yeah. So you can, there are two games that are playable. One is Thayer's Quest, which was released in the arcade.
Yeah, I remember that, yeah.
And the other one is this American football game where it kind of shows video footage of an American football game, and then you call out the kind of the next play, and it kind of changes to show the next play. So that was the thing about the Halcyon. It had voice recognition in 1985. Wow. And you can imagine it wasn't that good. You know, they said it had a vocabulary of about 200 or 300 words or something like that, which is not really that much when you think about it. And there's this brilliant footage. If you can search for it, there's the US show Computer Chronicles, which was a very long running kind of show in the US. And there's this great footage of Rick Dyer going on there and demonstrating the Halcyon, and the host just kind of saying, you know, he's like, right, Stuart, you can choose a route. And he's going, one, I'm sorry, I didn't understand you. One, please speak more clearly. One, please. And it just keeps going. And then he's just like, two, yes, you can carry on. So it's very embarrassing, kind of like one of those moments. You're like, oh, my God, I can't believe this is happening. You know, watching through your fingers, you know. In short, it doesn't really work that well. And they reckon the console itself would have cost a ridiculous amount of money because, you know, like you said, Laserdisc players were incredibly expensive at the time. Essentially you have to get a Laserdisc player and then have this console on top, and the cartridge goes in the console, and then an accompanying Laserdisc goes into the Laserdisc player, and then you have a keyboard. I mean, they reckon it would have cost about $2,500 or something.
It would have been a rich man's toy.
Yeah.
Wow. Very interesting. Very interesting. Amazing. Amazing. Just looking, the Enterprise, stuff on the ZX81, of course.
Yeah, that's it. There's a whole chapter as well on, one thing I really wanted to do. So
yeah.
I kind of wanted to tell like an alternative history of video games, really, because I think failure is kind of more interesting than success in many ways. And a lot of the things that are in this book, you know, it wasn't that they were bad. It was just that they were at the wrong time, or they didn't have the funding, or they, you know, they were years ahead of their time, like virtual reality in the early 90s. You know, it was a fantastic idea. It was just the tech at the time just wasn't quite up to it, you know, and it was just incredibly expensive. But also there's stories that you don't get to hear about, like what was happening in Germany. We talked about the Intertom, and what was happening in like Korea or Brazil. And I wanted to kind of like bring in more of a global history, you know, bring in these things, talk about machines that, you know, we don't ever talk about in the West, like the Daewoo ZX, which was Daewoo was this big Korean conglomerate. We probably know them in the UK best for making cars, but like all these kind of giant Korean conglomerates like Samsung, you know, they've got their fingers in all sorts of parties.
Yeah, they were all dipping their toes into the scene, wasn't they, these companies?
That's right, yeah. You know, they were making ships and musical instruments, and they were also making kind of game consoles. And so Korea, you know, had a really interesting history. They produced this whole line of ZX consoles. There was the ZX and the ZX-V and then, you know, various other ones down the line. And no one's ever heard of them outside of Korea. They were never exported outside of Korea. They're incredibly rare now to find. I can only know one collector who's got one, and he's in the US, and no one ever talks about them. But they were huge, absolutely huge, to the point where a few years ago they actually created a ZX mini console in Korea as like the kind of NES mini, but for the ZX, you know. And I think actually not one but two of them. So it had a big impact on that country. But then consoles just died a death in Korea, and then it became all about PCs.
Right.
But there was this period in the 80s where, you know, the ZX was massive. And they're beautiful. They're absolutely beautiful. These are the most beautiful consoles I've ever seen. The ZX-V, I don't know if you can find the picture of it in the book, but it's like this beautiful kind of like heart-shaped thing, this kind of arrow of a console with this beautiful kind of red color scheme, and you could get it in all sorts of different colors as well. And the original ZX 2 came in these amazing colors. It's the cutest, amazing looking console you've ever seen. And then they released one, the last one they did looked like the Starship Enterprise. It's even got a little disc on the top. It's absolutely remarkable kind of thing. So I feel like people...
That is, I'm looking at it now. That is mad.
Yeah.
Crazy design.
It was super hard to track down information on all of that stuff, though, because there's just there's very little about it. But I was lucky enough to get in touch with Sam Derbu, who's like a German expat who lives in Korea, and he specializes in kind of like researching kind of the history of Korean computers. And he told me so much about that, and he managed to dig up some brilliant kind of Korean articles from explaining about the history of the Zemix as well. So it was brilliant to kind of have those as a resource. But yeah, most people, they just shake their heads when I say, oh, have you heard of the Daewoo Zemix? But this is the stuff, this is what happened. This was what was happening in Korea, you know, and to them, you know, it's like us with talking about Sinclair Spectrums and, you know, Dragon 32s to someone in the US, and they're like, what? No, we had this.
There's one I'm looking at the moment, a Super Cassette Vision Ladies, 1985. Oh. This looks like it's been taken off the Barbie set. It's a pink console.
Yeah.
It's marketed towards girls, from what I can
gather. That's right, yeah. Yeah, the Super Cassette Vision Ladies. Well, for a start, amazing name. I mean, I can't... You can't beat that. And it came in a pink briefcase, which is fantastic.
Where was that released?
It was only released in Japan, as far as we know. But the Super Cassette Vision was also released in France.
Yeah.
As far as I know, the Ladies was only ever released in Japan. This is the pink version of the console that was specifically aimed towards girls. And it came with this game. Oh, no, I can't remember the name of it. It was Princess something something. But it was basically a kind of astrology game that was kind of endorsed by Japan's equivalent of Russell Grant or Mystic Meg. And it didn't do much. Like you put in your date of birth and answered a couple of questions, and then it gave you some spurious kind of prediction or for your future or something like that. It was a very thin idea for a game. But Milky Princess, that was what it was called. It was called Milky Princess.
Yeah. Get arrested Princess. For trying to publish a game like that.
That was it. So, yeah. But it was the Super Cassette Vision Ladies, it's very highly sought after now. And I spoke to Peter Lee, who's Nostalgia Nerd, better known as Nostalgia Nerd, and he'd spent years trying to track one down, and he managed to find one at auction because they don't come up very often. They're quite rare. But yeah, what a fascinating thing. It's quite a beautiful machine, really.
It's certainly striking, that's for sure. It catches your eye.
Why don't they make more consoles that come with pink briefcases? I think they're missing a trick. But there was all sorts of consoles made for girls. You know, there's a whole chapter in the book about called Any Color as Long as It's Pink, which is all about kind of consoles developed for girls. And there's the Casio Loopy, which was a console that printed stickers, which is quite a lovely thing now, although now that the sticker roll and the ink is so expensive to buy, no one wants to print anything anymore because it's like 30 quid a roll, you know, to buy a second hand. And then there's the Master System Girl. This was only made in Brazil, which was like a portable version of the Master System that was all completely wireless and had a little antenna that connected it with the TV. But obviously came in pink. Although the Casio Loopy was grey, interestingly, a kind of bluey grey. So, you know, you don't have to make your...
No, they don't have to be pink for girls, yeah.
But I think that whole thing, I talk about it in the book, like the idea that you have to make a separate console just for girls because they're like, you know, they need their own separate console. It's just such a ridiculous idea. We look back at it now, it's like, consoles should be for everyone. You know, we're not, there's not like boys' consoles and girls' consoles. So the very idea that you had to make, like, oh, we're going to make a pink version, that one's for the girls, you know, it's very ridiculous, very sexist.
It is, yeah, but it's history. It's great looking back at it. I was just something I've always wanted. I've just seen, it's only a small section in the book, but the Japanese Atari 2800.
Oh yeah, now that that's a kind of beautiful version of the 2600. You know, the Atari tried.
It's quite sleek looking, isn't it?
Yeah, it's really beautiful. It's really beautiful, and I think the kind of controllers ended up kind of being reused a bit for it. I think it was the 7800 that the design kind of like
for the American joypads. Yeah,
yeah, that's right. But yeah, Atari had a terrible time trying to crack the Japanese market. What happened was Epoch got the license to distribute the 2600 in Japan, but it was so expensive it didn't make any headway whatsoever. And like other consoles ended up overtaking it, and of course the Famicom came out, and then Epoch also made the Cassette Vision, which, and then later the Super Cassette Vision. And I think as well, the idea that they were competing with their own console was probably not brilliant if they were trying to flog Atari's one. And then Atari decided, right, we're going to have a go. And then they came up with this kind of redesign of the 2600 and brought it out as in Japan. But it never did that well. It was too expensive for a start. It was, and it already had lost out to the Japanese consoles by the time it kind of hit the market. But yeah.
And then you've got the Famiclones.
Yeah, I mean, that goes back. I wanted to do a chapter of Famiclones, which is like clones of the Famicom, because I think going back to the idea, like the history that we get in the UK and in the US as well, the history of video games was completely different in other parts of the world. Like there were machines that other countries never got, never heard of, you know, things that never took off. And for most countries that aren't kind of, you know, the US, Canada, Europe, Japan, the history of video games is tied to bootleg consoles, to Famiclones, you know, because the Famicom
one I'm
wasn't
looking at here that's in the shape of the Batman, the Batmobile.
Yeah, I mean, it was brilliant. The creativity that was on display, you know, there are thousands of these machines. They're all made by these countries, a lot of these companies, mostly based in like Taiwan and China. And they end up finding their way all around the world, and they get renamed different things in different countries, and they produce specific kind of designs for different countries as well. And like you said, there was one in the shape of a Batman car, which is fantastic. There's one, I think there was one in the shape of a Terminator. No, there was one called the Terminator. There was one, there's ones with Famicoms that come with keyboards as well. The idea that being, you know, you could pretend it was like a little PC. But, you know, for some people, you know, that might be their only, you know, particularly if you're in a particularly poor country, you know, that might be the only way you could ever get hold of a computer, by having a little Famiclone with a keyboard. So it was these things, you know, the Pegasus was a very big one in Poland. That was huge in Poland. And you know, if you speak to Polish people, a lot of them will remember the Pegasus, you know, because that was all they had. The Famicom wasn't distributed, or the NES wasn't distributed in those countries. It was really hard to get hold of some of these computers in, you know, countries in Africa and South America. And they had these things, the Famiclones. And the Famicom was super easy to pirate. There was no kind of security software on it, which is why it ended up being so, you know, widely reproduced. And then the NES came along and they introduced some security software for that. But yeah, so now I think there's more Famiclones out there than any other console. It's the most bootlegged console by far, and will always be. I think no one's going to break its record now. And they're making them even today. Nowadays, like and it's completely legal to do it as well, because the patents expired on the Famicom several years ago. And just hundreds of them. You just go and look on Amazon or somewhere, and you find, you know, millions of them, in all sorts of weird shapes. You know, there's ones that made to look like a Mega Drive or an N64 controller or all sorts of things. So I thought I'd do a little potted history of that, and particularly the Dendy, which was the Russian Famiclone that kind of paid hugely popular over there, and was even endorsed by Nintendo later on, bizarrely.
Really?
So the head of the Dendy executives had a meeting with I think it was Howard Lincoln in Nintendo US, and they said, essentially, right, we're going to turn a blind eye to the Dendy, but can you promote our games, and can you be an official launch partner for the Super NES and distribute the NES for us? So we'll just turn a blind eye to all the Dendy stuff, but help us get on board with the Super NES and don't throw it Sega. But the deal fell apart pretty quickly. And I think the Dendy had its own TV show on Russian kind of TV, and they would promote all of their kind of like Mega Drive clones and things like that as well. And Nintendo weren't particularly happy about that. So yeah, essentially the Dendy was a semi-official kind of clone of the Famicom.
Right. I'm looking through, and you cover stuff right through the 90s up until modern day, really, don't you? There's so much in here.
Yeah, yeah. So I think there's a few arcade machines I've tried to cover. There's Prop Cycle in there, which was my favourite arcade machines back in there. That was the one we had to kind of pedal a Laparopter, they called it. It was made by Namco.
Right.
In 1996, at the kind of height of just as the arcade scene was just about to decline, really.
Yeah.
Back in the time when everyone was trying to outdo each other in terms of interaction, and you know, Ridge Racer had its full scale car, and you're getting all these elaborate kind of shooting games, and you had to, for Prop Cycle, you had to kind of pedal this machine. And it was a wonderful game, but it's barely remembered now, and you hardly ever see it. And I had a real trouble trying to find pictures of it for the book, actually. I managed to contact a couple of people who had their own machines, but then I needed like a lead image. And in the end, thankfully, Andy at Arcade Club over in Bury managed to save me on that. I mean, he managed to rush me a picture of the machine. So there is one in Arcade Club. I think it's the one in Blackpool, actually.
Right,
if you want to go and play Prop Cycle for yourself, it's a wonderful thing.
There's some amazing stuff in this book. You've got all the virtual reality stuff as well from the early 90s. Some of those machines were huge.
Oh, the virtual reality stuff. Yeah, well, I managed to track down and speak to Richard Holmes, who is one of the four founders of virtual reality.
Mm.
He would kind of covered the engineering side of it all. And he was fascinating kind of font of information. They were on Tomorrow's World near constantly, I think, in the late 80s and early 90s. And it was so exciting kind of to see this. But I mean, looking back at it now, like the technology, I think it ran up about 15 frames per second.
Yeah.
And nowadays they kind of say you have to have about 60 frames per second to avoid kind of like motion sickness and things like that.
Mm.
So, but the actual tracking technology they used was super advanced and probably as good, if not better, than some of the headsets that they have today. They use this kind of magnetic tracking technology, which was incredibly expensive. Nowadays, most headsets use accelerometers and things like that. But back then, they had this kind of magnetic tracking system. But the trouble was, it's really prone to interference. So if you're kind of like got your virtual reality rig next to a metal gantry or something like that, then it just won't work because it kind of anything metal around it picks up on the interference.
Mm. I also noticed you've got a section on the VHS games as well from the late 80s.
It's funny that I started writing that section on VHS games when I originally was going to do it, because I wanted to do a section on the Action Max, which I'd never heard of. I think it was mostly released in the US, mostly based in the US, which was this VHS console. And then the more research I did, the more VHS consoles I uncovered. And there's just loads. I think there's about 14 different ones that I ended up kind of mentioning in the book.
Yeah, I remember seeing these. My mum used to get the Great Universal catalogue, and I'm sure they used to advertise them in there. But I remember seeing them advertised on TV as well, but they're not something I've ever really played.
Yeah.
They're interesting.
They're definitely interesting. I wouldn't say they're particularly good.
No, you know, they're not good, but yeah, interesting.
The interactivity is kind of limited. You know, you imagine you're playing this VHS tape, and usually you've got a laser gun or something like that, and you're shooting them, and it will register a hit, but nothing will change on the tape. You know,
you
won't get any visual feedback. But there are some really beautiful ones, like Road Blaster. Is one of the kind of ones that's available, and you know these games that were made for the Laserdisc kind of consoles. A few of them got conversions for the Video Challenger and some others. One of the interesting things, the Video Challenger, which is this handheld completely self. It was just a gun, essentially, with batteries in it. And you just pointed it at the screen and it had the score on the back. And if you got a hit by pointing it at these certain flashing lights and putting the trigger, then it registered at a point. And it would also dock points if you kind of like pointing at the screen when an enemy fired, you know. But interesting, you could use the video challenger to play the introduction to Transformers, the animated series.
Really?
the Japanese one. So the in Japan, the video challenger was distributed by Takara, who also made Transformers.
Right. Yeah.
And I can't remember the exact name of the series. It's in the book, but there's one of the series of Transformers when about halfway through that animated series, they've added in kind of like targets for the video challenger in the introduction. So you could, you know, score points by shooting these targets in the introduction to each episode. And they put the video challenger in the episode. So you'll see the characters holding like these video challenger guns.
I'll have to check that out.
Yeah.
I was a big Transformers fan as a kid. Not so much the Japanese stuff, but yeah, I'll have to have a look at that.
Yeah.
Sounds interesting. So have you got a favourite section of the book? Is there a device or something you
the one thing I'm really fascinated in? By the one thing I'm really fascinated by, I think, is the last chapter, which is on the Avatar machine, I wrote about this years and years and years ago, and I couldn't find out much information, but I managed to track down the guy who made it and interviewed him and managed to kind of do this chapter for the book where I kind of actually speak to the person who created it. He's called Mark Owens and he's an artist. And he did this while he was at art college, this thing. And it's called the Avatar Machine. And basically what it is, it's a VR visor that you put on your face. And then you wear this suit that kind of makes you look like a low poly character from something like Final Fantasy VII.
Yeah.
And then there's a pole sticking out your back with a fisheye lens camera pointing at the back of your body. So when that feeds into the VR headset. So what you're seeing when you're wearing the suit is yourself from behind. And you can, so it feels like.
That sounds all types of dangerous when you're running around.
It's like it makes you feel like you're in a video game because you're seeing yourself from a third person perspective. And Mark used to take it to all these places and, you know, have people kind of try on the suit and everyone's like, oh my God, this is so strange. You know, I feel like I'm in a video game and it feels like your arm isn't yours. You know, you're waving your arms around. You feel like this feels like this is someone else's arm because I'm seeing it from it's in front of me, but it's my arm. It's very strange. But he wanted to explore this kind of sense of dissociation you get with playing a video game. And, yeah, it's a really fascinating, weird thing. And he did make a few of them to sell. But only maybe a dozen or so. And the remaining machines are kind of in a lockup somewhere in London. So it's a
very wouldn't be cheap to do either. But yeah, that is a mad idea.
But I'm surprised that hasn't been picked up on. Because I think it's a brilliant. I can imagine, I would love to give it a go. And it feels like the kind of thing like a YouTuber or someone would immediately leap on and say, oh, this is fun. You know, why don't we view ourselves from third person? But
maybe it's one of those ideas, you know, it was maybe too early. Maybe it's something he needs to try again now, maybe. I don't know. How long ago was it that he'd done this?
So that was, I think it was 2008, around that time.
I think YouTube was only just kicking off around that time, wasn't it? Maybe it's something that needs to be looked at again. Yeah, you know, I think it's an amazing book you've got there. And no, seriously, there's so much in there. I'm learning loads from it, just browsing through it now. It's amazing. Available now, is it?
It is available now. So you can order it direct from the publishers at Pen and Sword. So it's been published by White Owl, which is an imprint of Pen and Sword. They mostly kind of do military books, but they do a few gaming ones as well. So if you just type Curious Video Game Machines, Pen and Sword, you should be able to come up with a link. But you can also get it through Amazon, Waterstones, WH Smith, all the kind of usual resellers if you search their websites. And it'll be available in the US as well, I think, in January. So that's being distributed by Casemate over there. So if you search Casemate Curious Video Game Machines, it should come up. But like I said, you can also find it on Amazon. So that might be your easiest bet. I think Amazon haven't started shipping it yet. It's available now from the publisher, from Pen and Sword, from direct from their website. But Amazon, I don't think they've got the stock in just yet, but it should be shipping soon.
Okay, well, we'll put a link on our show notes to the actual publisher so you can get it direct from them.
It's good. I get more money if you buy it from the publisher as well. Oh, than well, if you go from Amazon. So go buy it from the publisher.
Use the link on our website. Very well done, mate. That's a great read.
Oh, thank you. I enjoyed writing it. I'm really looking forward to kind of having people get it in their hands, and you know, it's and I hope, like I said earlier, I hope that it sparks some interest in these machines, and that you know, people look into them a bit more and find out a bit more about the stuff, because I did as much as I could, but there's only so much I was able to kind of do. I reckon there's more work to be done.
I think, you know, there's another book in there, definitely. By the sounds.
Oh, I'd love to do another one. Everyone saying. Buy this book so I can write another one, please. Make it a success so I can do this for a living. I would love to keep churning these out, because there's so many more I would like to do. So many more machines.
Like I say, it's for me been gaming pretty much since the age of 5. I'm 48, nearly 49 now. And obviously running this podcast, I know a lot about a lot of different machines, but this has been a real eye-opener, because, as you say, different parts of the world, they got totally different things to what we had here in the UK. And I guess here in the UK, we have our own stuff, and we also get to see what was going on in Japan and America, but this book covers a whole lot more than that. So I think it's really interesting. It's educational for someone like me.
Oh, good. I'm pleased.
Someone who thinks he knows it all. No, I obviously don't. You teach me a lot, Lewis.
Oh, it's been fun. Thank you.
No problem, mate. Yes, it's been a good laugh having you on. Very interesting. And, I urge everyone out there, if you like the sound of it, check it out. It's a very, very good read.
All right. Cheers.
Cheers, Lewis. Take care.
Take care.
So there you go, guys. I hope you enjoyed that chat with Lewis. He is such a nice guy. And seriously, that book is really, really interesting. Although I've got it in PDF format, I'm going to order the proper book itself. And I'm going to do that from the actual publisher, which Lewis mentions, penandsword.co.uk, as it is only £19.60 via them, rather than 20-odd quid via any other seller. And Lewis gets a better cut, apparently. So, yeah, really, really nice book. Some really interesting stuff in it. It's not often I can read through a book and actually learn stuff about video games, but this book is certainly educational for me. Anyway, like I say, I hope you enjoyed the episode and the chat with Lewis. We'll be speaking to you soon. As I've mentioned previously, the plans for the Christmas episode are in full swing. We're doing polls for top 10 games, which Mads is working on. We've already done the Spectrum and the Master System and the NES so far. So we'll be publishing the results of all those soon. Okay, take care, guys, and we'll speak to you soon. Bye-bye.
From now on, unlike your parents were, you are the secret force of Retro Asylum.
Playing so fast, they're the only ones who can take you back in time. They play old games, they're more retro than J1 Optimus Prime. At home or the arcade for adventures.